A pastor tells this story. In the cereal section of the grocery store, I saw a couple who had visited our church a time or two. I greeted them and asked if they had found a church. They had. They said, "We liked your church, but after a while, we realized that everybody there seemed to be involved in a lot of service ministries, and we got the feeling they were giving quite a bit of money, too. At our new church, we feel free to do whatever we want and just leave the rest alone." This is complicated. On one hand, the search for a faith community can be a hard one. Many of you know this firsthand. And I can't help but be glad that these people found a comfortable fit. But a closer read might leave us curious about the spiritual depth of this new church, where no service or generosity is encouraged, and there seems to be little guidance about life's important questions. About this story, consultant Dan Hotchkiss observes that a congregation's power to do good springs partly from the promises its members make to one another. A congregation's power to do good springs partly from the promises its members make to one another. Hotchkiss recommends against congregations where we feel free to do whatever we want and just leave the rest alone. And he lifts up instead the benefits of devotional relationship, and accountability is a part of that. This is a good message for Unitarian Universalists, because we tend to focus on the preciousness of freedom rather than emphasize the importance of promises that bind or obligate us. We often describe our community as a place where we need not subscribe to any creed. And this freedom of belief means that we get to access wisdom from a variety of sources. This is a strength of our tradition. But there's a downside, too. Too extreme a focus on freedom can result in a falsely inflated sense of ourselves as lone individuals. When this happens, we believe that our decisions are solely ours alone, influenced by and impacting no one else. When freedom of choice is not tied to deep values about collective flourishing, it's not actually freedom, because it won't help us all live freely. It's carelessly doing whatever we, the individual we, want, with no understanding of interconnection, of how your behavior affects mine, of how mine affects yours. In the sense that we are never without the influence of the people and the society that surrounds us, we are, in fact, never completely free. Culture and context always exists, always binds us. And that can be both blessing and curse. If we don't see that forces frame the situations in which we find ourselves, and these forces could be about your family dynamic, they could be economic, religious, political, but they are there, these forces that frame the situations in which we find ourselves. And if we don't see them, then we become unable to look at them and ask, are my choices being shaped by something deep and meaningful? Like the grocery store shoppers, who were the subject of the study in our reading today, I too have been overwhelmed by endless jam products. There are so many out there, and some of them are called jelly or preserves or fruit spread, and is that the same thing as jam? Now, under consumer capitalism, this is freedom at its greatest. Because if you can afford it, and that's another problem, there are so many choices. I have to admit, I really like consumer choice. But is that real freedom? I think real freedom has to be about more than the mere presence of multiple options, with no process of vetting their quality. By quality, I mean, does having this choice put me in touch with something meaningful? I would argue that if you find a congregation that helps you commit to service work and generosity, then you've probably chosen wisely. You would have given up the freedom to not value helping others, and there are real implications to that. But hopefully you would have gotten something more precious in return. Opportunities for deep meaning like this tend not to be found in the jam aisle. If we're not totally free, where does that leave us? Is bondage the opposite of freedom? Well, yes, at least according to Dan Hotchkiss, who told the story about church shoppers in the cereal aisle. Bondage can be oppressive. It can mean enslavement, captivity. These things are hideously wrong. But Hotchkiss says that bondage can also be voluntary, be good, devotional even. In fact, the power to make promises that bind us is part of being a full participant in society. Without it, we couldn't purchase or rent a home, and we couldn't charter a Unitarian Universalist fellowship. It's no accident that a main thrust of immigrant rights organizing is about just this: being able to get official identification, which in and of itself is a promise that binds us, is not trivial in modern life. Promises are not only legally powerful. Devotional commitments are spiritually powerful as well. When I first picked up The Year of Living Biblically, one man's humble quest to follow the Bible as literally as possible, and it's available in the bookstore if you want to pick it up too, I was sure that author A.J. Jacobs would side with freedom over obligation, concluding that the Bible has some great resources, sure, but the greater gift was to be able to select ideas and behaviors a little more spontaneously, a little more by individual fancy. Maybe as a minister, I shouldn't admit that my gut reaction, even just to the title, was, oh, this guy's going to get sick of the Bible. But that's what I thought. I was wrong. A.J. Jacobs reflects that in his previous life, with no religious affiliation and no spiritual identity or outlook, what he perceived as freedom might actually have been getting in the way of commitment to what he most deeply cares about. He finds that the structure of biblical rules and regulations kept him on track devotionally by letting him sidestep the process of having to personally consider the potential wisdom in every book in the universe. As he said in the reading, he appreciated having some of those jam jars taken away. It helped him commit to fewer practices with more depth. He focused more on assisting the homeless guy on 77th because he wasn't multitasking with also caring about Cameron Diaz's love life. Coming across a verse in Thessalonians, which is part of the Christian scriptures, that instructs readers to give thanks in all circumstances, he experiences how powerful it can be to zero in on just one practice and do it over and over again. On day 263 of his Year of Living Biblically, he writes, I feel myself becoming an extremist, at least in some areas, like my obsession with gratefulness. I can't stop. Just now, I press the elevator button and am thankful that it arrives quickly. I get onto the elevator and am thankful that the elevator cable doesn't snap and plummet me to the basement. I get to the fifth floor and I'm thankful that I didn't have to stop on the second or third or fourth floor. I get out and I'm thankful that my wife Julie left the door unlocked so I don't have to rummage for my King Kong key ring. I walk in and I'm thankful that my son Jasper is home and healthy and stuffing his face with pineapple wedges. And on, I'm actually muttering to myself, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's an odd way to live, he continues, but also kind of great and powerful. I've never before been so aware of the thousands of little good things, the thousands of things that go right every day. It's more of an appreciation than a thanks, a reminder to myself. Pay attention, pal. Savor this moment. It's not about thanks, he says. It's about going deep. That takes practice. A few weeks ago, I spent a week at the UU Ministers Association's Institute for Excellence in Ministry. My seminar was led by Dr. Mark Hicks, who teaches at Meadville Lombard, our UU seminary in Chicago. When we talked about how to make our congregations places of deep meaning for those in them, his answer surprised me. It was deceptively simple. We need to find ways to practice where we want to go on a daily basis, he said. And then he asked us, a bunch of ministers taking notes about how to do it all right. So what's our skill set? How do we practice where we want to go on a daily basis? I hadn't thought of it that way before, but in my own life, I do try to practice on a daily basis where I want to go. When I moved here this summer without my spouse, Amy, it was clear to us right away that the meaning of us having separate lives was not going to fit. We needed to figure out how to continue sharing a sense of home with each other, even while she is living in Florida and I am living in Wisconsin. So here's where the daily practice comes in. Every day, I take one picture with my phone of our life in Appleton, and I send it to her in a message. This has helped me build my skill set of ways to be in relationship with Amy and with my new home here at the same time. The devotional practice of snapping a photograph helps me feel connected to her. But after a while, I began to feel more connected to Appleton also. Maybe because I had all this visual evidence that I lived in such an interesting, beautiful place, from the silly ad for heart-shaped pizza on February 14th to a stark black branch against a gray sky that seemed to glow with reflected sunlight on snow. Depth of my devotion to Amy encouraged and amplified the depth of my devotion to Appleton because I practiced it. I built my skill set. Sending a picture message was not new to me. I've done that occasionally since I've had that technology. But the practice took on a whole new depth when I began to do it as a daily ritual. A.J. Jacobs and I both came to the same realization then. His with his year of biblical literalism, and I with my more humble photo-a-day ritual. The more each of us was able to appreciate something, the more it was easy to appreciate everything else. An activity that's meaningful becomes a ritual practice of devotion when we commit to mining its depths, rather than getting distracted every time something else that might also be wise crosses our path. One of you told me the other day that you love yoga so much, you drag yourself to class even if you're tired and not loving it in that moment. Even when you have an invitation to see an acclaimed documentary or to catch up with an old friend instead, both worthy pursuits, you still go to yoga because you committed to go to yoga. Rituals not of our individual creation are like this too. They also connect us. A friend of mine who is recently exploring Catholicism learned how to pray the rosary for the nights when insomnia visits and she is miserable. She reports feeling powerfully connected through this ritual to people across the globe and throughout time who have joined her in this very devotion, who are perhaps cradling different beads on a different string at the same time she holds her own. That's how it works. Devotion to the small and singular, like a rosary, becomes devotion to the large and plural, like people throughout time and across culture. And so going deep is actually the way to go wide as well. Mr. Berkowitz, A.J. Jacobs' teacher in the reading, also experiences this. There's a proper procedure, he says. You put on your right shoe, then your left shoe, then you tie your left shoe, then you go back and tie your right shoe. Mr. B. can't explain the precise evolution of that practice, although I guess the rabbis tell us too is as good a reason as any. But he does it anyway. And by doing so, he has regular, physical, embodied connection to those who have put their own shoes on in that same certain way since long before any of us were born, people whose names we will never know. When his year is over, AJ does admit feeling some relief. Right away, he shaves off his beard, which he had grown without cutting or even trimming, to be in keeping with the instructions to do so in the Hebrew scriptures. But he's stuck with some of it. I'm much more grateful than I used to be, he says. Gratitude is a huge theme in the Bible. Perhaps this is boasting, which is highly unbiblical, but I think the year made me a slightly better person. Remember, though, it wasn't about the thankfulness. It was about the reminder to pay attention and savor life, to practice where we want to go on a daily basis, which is to live a life of devotion. The freedom of choice we value so highly can best be realized when we exercise it. So choose, but choose deeply, knowing your interconnection. Instead of picking a community where you are left totally to your own devices, find somewhere you are encouraged to devote the best of yourself. Choose to live meaningfully. It will require commitment, but it will enrich you again and again. To whom or what are you devoted? Not just in a moment of fleeting inspiration, but on a daily basis. And how has that commitment deepened your life?